already acclaimed in boardrooms the world over, How the Deal Was Done brings together the most interesting and candid dealmakers in investment history. And now, How the Deal Was Done, with your host, Laura Queen, founder and CEO of 29 Bison.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of How the Deal Was Done. I'm excited to be joined today by my colleagues Mark Prine and Matt Lean as we talk a little bit about things we've been seeing and hearing in the marketplace through Q2 of 2025. Mark, would you like to introduce yourself to our guests?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Laura. Mark Prine, Senior Advisor with 29 Bison and our local resident industrial organizational psychologist.
Thanks, Mark. Matt?
Thanks, Laura. I'm excited to be on the podcast. Matt Lane, I'm a senior advisor as well to 29 Bison. I've got years of experience working with middle market, high growth companies, most of them private equity backed. I've been both a business executive and a human capital executive in those companies.
Fantastic. Thank you both for joining us. I love the idea that we're actually the ones that are spending some time on this podcast together, sharing some of the observations we've made over the last couple of months. Each of us independently and together have spent time attending conferences, seminars, webinars, even individual experiences we've had with clients, and we're seeing some interesting things happen in the marketplace. I'd love for you both, and I'll start with Mark, but I'd love for you both to share some of the general observations you've been making around human capital and private equity in the first quarter of our 2025 fiscal year.
Sure. I think, you know, starting off at the macro first is that uncertainty is uncertain, and there's a lot of places where there's hesitation to make a lot of moves because people are unsure about what's coming next, right? I think, you know, we're working with a number of funds who are in fundraising mode. We're working with a number of funds who are hesitant to make some big platform acquisitions, seeing a lot of roll up and, you know, people trying to do the right thing while also being nimble is a big piece right now, given the current market conditions.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Matt.
Yeah, my sense is there's a growing appetite for human capital solutions across private equity firms, portfolio companies, but there is that caution and hesitation given the market conditions. It was very stark to me. I noticed in the back half of Q4 and into the first month of Q1, there was noticeable momentum around a lot of activities around human capital and just deals in general. And since, you know, late January, there's been a lot of caution and hesitation, just given a lot of the economic and political uncertainty that has kind of been the story of the day for the last 90 days.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. And in the executive assessment world and a lot of the stuff that I've been doing, I've been getting a lot more questions about the analytical agility of the leader, right? Are they able to pivot? Are they able to build the right contingency plans? A lot of the questions that maybe calmed down a little bit after COVID, right? These were a lot of things that were top of mind concerns during COVID, but now it's just more like, okay, well, what's plan C if we run through plan A and B and we end up at a dead end?
That's a really good point, Mark. Matt, like you, and we're all living in the same space and providing support to each other on many of the deals we're touching. But I too have seen a pretty significant shift in activity. I think we're also seeing somewhat macro, longer hold periods for many of the portfolio companies we're touching, which changes the calculus as we think about overall operation, both human capital and, you know, other aspects of those businesses. And we'll touch on that a little bit more as we go through today's conversation. One of the things that I'll call it witnessed over the last probably 2 years, but I think it's just true of the space that we sit in, is a bit of a jumble as far as language about the work we do is concerned. So we've attended events or participated in podcasts or webinars where the work that we do is called human capital, but defined more as talent. We've seen circumstances where it is defined as talent, but it is more human resources oriented. So I think there's an emerging need and desire for having conversations around the work that we're doing and applying it to fund level activities and portfolio company operations. Yet I think there is still opportunity for us to work through what the definitions of each of these aspects of the work that we're doing is and how it begins to inform some of our thinking about what service levels that look like, what areas of organizational operation we're talking about, et cetera. Matt, I'd love to hear from you as you think about the definition, for example, of human capital. So what is human capital to you?
Yeah, so it's a great question and a great observation on your part, Laura. I would say that for me personally, when I use the word human capital, I'm intentionally, you know, avoiding human resources, and I'm intentionally avoiding the word talent to talk more broadly about the impacts from a people strategy perspective that you can have across a business. And so I think of human capital as the most broad way of thinking about all the levers you can pull from a people and talent perspective across a portfolio company, as an example in private equity. And so, and I, the word human capital, I guess for me resonates a little bit using the word capital, which I think is a term that, you know, resonates in the private equity world as well. Just like there's financial capital, there's human capital. I think of human resources. Unfortunately, I think human resources has a dated feeling for people of, you know, kind of 1950s General Electric, and I've got the human resources department that is managing, you know, the people part of our business from an operations and administration and a compliance perspective. Fair or unfair, that often is kind of how a lot of people think of human resources and that kind of limited view. Talent often is, to me, related to specifically the recruiting and executive search world, like the individual talent. Like, we need to find a new CEO, we need to find a new CFO, we need to maybe do some assessments on the team and the talent. So a lot of times when I hear the word, you know, we're focused on a talent strategy or we've got a talent partner, it's usually focused on the recruitment and or assessment of an executive. And so for me, human capital is a broader umbrella that encompasses all of that, with a real eye towards what is our strategy to really drive value creation through people and talent.
Great. Mark, I'd love for you to weigh in on this topic, and particularly to talk about talent and talent assessment as it fits mm-hmm. into this lexicon.
Yeah, I think Matt, kind of, I want to pick up where you left off, because I just spent some time at a CHRO summit of one of our partners where they brought in all of their CHROs from their entire portfolio and kind of brought them together for a couple of days of learning. And one of the things that I led a session on was actually making sure that they are connecting a talent strategy to the overall value creation strategy. What are the things that you are looking to actualize out of this business, and how are you ensuring that people are aligned in a way that will drive value the way that the thesis is set up to do? And so really focusing on the owner of the talent strategy to be leadership and direct managers, and getting it away from it just being the HR department, right? The human capital, the talent, the chief people officer, sure, they should be the stewards of it. They should be maybe helping to architect that plan and that strategy, but making sure that it's actually penetrating down throughout the organization and that you're thinking about it in a way that you're executing on it hand in hand with just day-to-day execution of the business, right? And so going back to the talent assessment question that you're kind of talking about, it's understanding that value creation plan and then having a particular model of what are the key behaviors, what are the key things that we need to do in order to, you know, actualize our approach, right? If we traditionally had a sales team that was more of a farmer mentality, and now in this new approach, growth strategy says we need more hunters, well, it's making sure that we have the right competency model in place and then are assessing the team both based on what have they done in the past and what are they going to be doing moving forward, right? Laura, you and I have worked a number of times through 9-box exercises with clients and helping to make sure that they are really thinking about their talent in terms of who is going to drive us forward, who are the people that we know are just the core worker bees going to get us where we need to get, and who are the people who maybe were really helpful yesterday and they got us to where we are, but they're not the right people in the right seats moving forward. Mm-hmm. And really having a systematized viewpoint of how are we going to assess talent? How are we going to judge the people, you know, and help get people through that change curve from what got us to this investment to what's going to get us to the next exit.
Mm-hmm. Real, I think, Mark, really important points, and I'll do a little bit of wraparound on this particular topic. In one conversation I participated in earlier this year at a conference, the topic of the conversation was human capital due diligence. At least that's what it said on the, you know, agenda. As the conversation got started, what I heard was talent assessment. It was really about the evaluation of individuals at the C-suite level moving into roles with a particular portfolio company. In most cases, I would say that was happening at the platform acquisition time. In some cases, it was replacement later on. But I think it goes back to what Matt was saying about using human capital as a term that speaks to the larger framework. When we typically think about human capital diligence, for example, we're thinking about everything from payroll and HR operations, the compliance, the nuts and bolts, the systems and technology. In many cases, it includes things like occupational health and wellness, culture, all of those pieces, as well as talent and talent assessment, and thinking about it for the entire arc of the hold period. So, Mark, to the point that you're making, when you're thinking about both talent and human capital overall, it's the prioritization changes on the basis of the investment thesis and the operating strategy for each of these organizations, and it changes on the basis potentially of the hold period. You know, I used this example with someone the other day. If you know that you have a hold period, or you're a very short distance away from exit, deciding that this is the year you're going to put in place a new HRIS strategy probably doesn't make a lot of sense. What are the other things you could prioritize that increase greater value, that reduce compliance risk, that situate the organization better for some kind of transaction or transformation in a very short period of time? If, however, you know that you have a longer runway and it's going to create operational efficiencies, it's going to improve your talent acquisition pipeline, all of those kinds of things, maybe that's the thing that you prioritize in an earlier roadmap or value creation plan.
I think that you're all, you know, exactly right. And one thing that we haven't mentioned is actually the org design, right? Do we have, you know, forget, do we have the right people in the right seats? Do we have the right chairs in the room before we even identify what it is we're doing? And, you know, identifying what are those critical roles that are going to be those high leverage points, and making sure that you've got a good bench strength into those roles, right? A lot of the times, you know, I agree with you that people focus on the executive leadership and do we have the right people and do we have the right succession plan and all of these things. But sometimes the most critical role in the organization is two levels down from that executive and that right. C-suite. Right. And are we really thinking about who's touching our clients and our customers and our team on a more regular basis than the people who are in the executive team meetings or in the board meetings? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that has been overlooked in the past, and with the longer hold period has allowed some of our work to penetrate deeper into the organization.
Right. That totally makes sense.
Hey, Laura, can I go back to just kind of bringing this full circle back to something that Mark said in his earlier comments that I think is really important is in any organization, private equity or not, the job of the most senior human resources or human capital leader in the organization is to build a people and talent strategy that's in support of the business strategy.
Right.
Full stop, right? And,
right.
and Mark
right.
kind of summed that up. And in private equity language, that business strategy that you need to build a talent strategy in support of is often referred to as the investment thesis or the value creation plan that falls out of that investment thesis. And so it's really important for the human capital leader or the PE firm's portfolio operations teams to really understand what are the key levers in the value creation plan and what is needed to be done from a people and talent strategy perspective to support that. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, to Mark's point, it may be an org design issue. It may be a tech company that all of a sudden now needs to move a lot of its development capabilities offshore, right? And that's a massive org design effort. It could be a talent acquisition or talent retention challenge that exists because there's a desire to take a healthcare services company and grow it in a really hot market where it's hard to find the healthcare providers like nurses or veterinarians that you need mm-hmm. to build the business. And so the human capital leader's role is to figure out what is the right talent acquisition and talent retention strategy to go get those highly skilled people that we need. And these are, to Mark's point, both cases that I just mentioned are roles that are beneath the management team, right? They're mm-hmm. not, hey, we need to get a new CFO or CEO in place. It's what are the critical roles in the organization and how can the human capital leadership team, whether that's the CHRO or human capital portfolio operations leader, how can they help support that?
Mm-hmm. And to your point, right, this is diet and exercise, right? There is no sexy Ozempic here of way that they can get from A to Z. And right. it's actually where the longer hold period allows the company to mature and gives it a little bit more opportunity to mature faster and longer and gives a better story when you're going out to sell
right.
and able to show that robustness.
Yeah, I think, Mark, you reason an interesting, I'll call it adjunctive conversation around this, right? Which is to say, years ago, when we were looking at what created value or how market value was captured for organizations, we were looking at things like property, plant, and equipment. What we know is that whole thesis has changed in the marketplace. It's human capital, people, talent, and their ability to create value for organizations. In many ways, these are intangible assets for those businesses. They're the thing that creates value for these businesses. They're the thing that inspires someone to want to purchase or invest in a business. And as you're thinking about the potential for exit, more and more we see questions around what does the culture look like? How does the leader factor into, or the leadership team factor into the culture? How does that translate to things like patient outcomes, patient satisfaction, NPS scores, all of those kinds of things? And so, you know, paying attention, I think both of you have shared your views on this. I agree with you completely. But attending to what are those critical roles in the organization and where are the players? You know, how is it that you're accounting for the players and the potential shift in need for those players as organizations move through the arc of their hold period or their life cycle, right? Whether or not they're private equity owned it is somewhat inconsequential as you think about the life stage of these organizations, but being able to tell a story that speaks to how value is attended to in the organization, how you invest back in that value, and what that looks like for a successor leadership team or a successor acquirer is really critical to being able to extract value out of the investments you've made in people, human capital writ large. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. So Another thing we've talked about as a group that I'd like to share with our audience is some of the observations we've made about talent, human capital, human resources in tiered organizations. So at, you know, at the larger organization level, the imperatives are very different than they are as we're looking at middle market or lower middle market organizations. And I'd love for each of you to kind of share on the basis of our conversations and the things we're seeing in the marketplace, what's different, what's similar, how do, you know, how should portfolio company leadership teams and investment partners think about what's different in those different marketplaces around issues of human capital? Matt, would you like to start?
Sure. I mean, that's a big question with lots of lots of runway to cover. You know, I think large cap PE firms and their portfolio companies, I mean, they tend to be billion-dollar plus companies, right? And they've got, you know, fully formed management teams as well. And most of those management team, whether it's the CFO or CHRO, they've got functions that are, you know, probably fairly robust. You know, in some cases, they may be, you know, still deficient and need to grow. And so in those markets, private equity firms often, you know, tend to, let's focus on getting the right management team in place. They've got the budget, they've got the team size, and let's try to get out of their way and let them run the business, right? And then you take the other extreme, like lower middle market private equity firms and their portfolio companies who might be, you know, $25 million in revenue and a few million dollars in EBITDA, they're going to have a very different you know, makeup of their portfolio companies. They're going to be much smaller, much more nimble businesses. Their management teams may not be fully flushed out. In many cases, in our world, businesses of that size don't have a CHRO, right? Mm-hmm. They've got a director of HR who's just making sure to get people paid and make sure benefits are done. And there's not a lot of strategic work that's being done yet. And that may be okay. But as they, if the plan is to scale to a $100 million plus business, there's work to do. There's wood to chop. And then, you know, kind of in the middle, you got the middle market firms that are investing in portfolio companies that maybe $100 million to $500 million. And they're, you know, all over the map sometimes. They've got, they're still maybe operating like a really small company, and they've got a lot of work to do from a human capital strategy perspective and execution perspective. In other cases, they might have a pretty strong and developed management team with good supporting cast. And so it's important. I'm always a big believer in, and I've always used the term, to build out stage appropriate solutions. Mm-hmm. So like, let's use performance management or performance assessment systems and processes that you might want to put in place. Well, the processes and systems that you need in that lower middle market where the company's 25 million is different than what might be needed in the middle market that's a couple hundred million. And that's different than a company that's $1 billion plus and might have 1,000 plus employees. And so it's imperative for the human capital leaders and the PE firms that support them, as to play out that example, is to build stage appropriate solutions. Sometimes a performance assessment system that is, you know, built off spreadsheets and Word documents may be good enough for a company mm-hmm. that only has 100 employees, right? And you don't need the most elegant, fancy solution. It may, the company, not the team, might not be able to adopt it, and you might not be able to afford it, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in a larger organization with 1,000 plus employees, you need a little bit more of a robust solution. But on the same token, that $1 billion company doesn't need the same robust solution that General Electric has either, right? Mm-hmm. So you really gotta think through what is the right sized and stage appropriate solution. And that's true, not just in HR, that's true in finance, that's true in sales and marketing, et cetera.
Good. Right. Mark, your thoughts.
Yeah,
so many things to say.
So I think you're absolutely right. And the piece that you didn't mention is in that lower middle market, usually it's a founder led business still at that point. And a lot of our clients go to market as, we're the PE firm that partners with founders. And whether it is that, you know, newer founder who's kind of struck gold with some entrepreneurial spirit, or it's that multi-generational business that is maybe thinking about taking some chips off the table, you know, there's a few different aspects and areas where we're being brought in to help them professionalize the business. And that's without making changes, but maybe scaffolding around that founding team. And it's helping people recognize, you know, what got you here isn't going to get you to that next exit. And scaffolding around, okay, you're a CEO who's really good at sales and maybe really good at product marketing and really good at some of the ideation, but you don't have some of the just business acumen rigor to turn this into a real business away from being a product and a group of people. And so, you know, what would it be if we bring in a president to compliment you as the CEO and start to think about, you know, growing and scaling the business? What are the processes in place that will help to, you know, make that expansion that you're looking at possible? Right. You know, and this is especially true with our clients where they've never made an acquisition, right? In the history of the business, they've never made an acquisition. And that is just, you know, integration is an underdeveloped muscle that they just need to be able to flex. And so I think, you know, everything that you're saying is exactly true. And I think that there's just that other piece of, you know, okay, it's time to grow up.
I'm going to weave a little bit of what Matt was saying with what you're saying, Mark, somewhat together, because I had this circumstance come up with a client the other day. As they, right after the platform acquisition, they went to market and brought in an operating officer for the organization. And they're now, you know, relatively close to their exit and thinking about org design issues and managing through some of the integration of successively acquired smaller businesses. And one of the issues the CEO is addressing right now is the, I'm going to call it, over institutionalization of some of the HR processes. You know, they went to market to find this operating executive for the organization who came from a very large business in, you know, Fortune 100 organization. And the general view is that they have now over-engineered some of the internal processes so that, A, it's too cumbersome for the folks in the organization to deal with. Some of the leadership and management team don't even understand the terminology being used around some of this, you know, newly engineered process and procedure. And it's taking away from the culture, which is really interesting, right? It's getting in the way of a very intentional, somewhat casual culture in a high technology environment where people very much attune themselves to how am I being treated? How am I being managed? What is the casual conversation on a day-to-day basis that allows me to know how I'm doing well, what my career advancement opportunities are, those kinds of things. And, you know, I think both of you have spoken about, you know, what are the really critical roles in the organization. But I think that, you know, I'll call it stage, age, and culture appropriateness, the fit for the organization in a very intentional way, all need to be weighed into the mix when we're thinking about what needs to be preserved as part of the organization because it's the magic. And what is it that needs to be tweaked and how much tweaking? Because we, you know, as in this case, we can go too far tweaking things.
I love your story. I love your example, Laura. I mean, it resonates with me big time in that I've seen too often that when, particularly in the lower middle market and middle market portfolio companies where, you know, you've got a problem, whether it's in the go-to-market processes or financial processes or performance, human resources, human capital processes, like the performance assessment one that I talked about earlier. And you feel like we got to fix that, right? And then the problem is you come in and you over-engineer it. Mm-hmm. I use that term all the time, too often. And that is a kiss of death for a small growth stage company to have over-engineered processes. Simpler is better, right? When you don't have any type of performance assessment process, to use that example, mm-hmm. and then you come in and put in something wildly sure. cumbersome, that's the worst thing you can do. So yeah. you have to kind of crawl, walk, run. And so put in a process that is better than what you had before, but don't overcomplicate it. Simpler is always better. And that's why often, you know, executives who don't have experience in middle market growth stage companies who want to get into private equity, you know, often the experience that they have in spades, you know, from larger enterprise organizations isn't relevant right. to the problems they're trying to solve in smaller growth stage middle market companies.
I was about to say the exact same thing, Matt, where, you know, the number of our clients who get enamored by a logo on a resume and they want to bring them in, and I'm putting this, you know, potential executive through an assessment, and I'm like, they're a really good CFO in 10 years. Like, come back right. to them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it just, you know, the nimbleness, the roll up their sleeves, the, you know, and going back, you've used the performance management, performance assessment a lot, right? This is why we talk a lot to our clients about some of the OKR methodology, mm-hmm. where people see the connection between what they are doing, what they are at, you know, the feedback that they're getting, and how it ties into the overall goals of the organization, right? You know, if you could just add that with a little bit of basic, here's how you can give people good feedback, because a lot of the times sure. your manager was a really good developer and got promoted to managing all of the rest of the developers and they just haven't done it before, right? Just some of that just rudimentary type learning and experience. That's all that they need in order to, you know, really be able to move things forward. But I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, and Laura, you mean, you talked about nimbleness, Mark, and Laura, your example is that, look, smaller companies, you know, obviously have less mature and often sloppy processes, and that's a weakness of theirs. But a strength of theirs is their size and therefore mm-hmm. their agility and nimbleness.
Right. Right.
And sometimes when you bring in a new executive who wants to implement all these processes that are probably better 10 years from now, they're actually suffocating the agility and nimbleness that's part of the culture of the organization. So you're actually not playing to your strengths at that point, right? You're actually suffocating them.
Yeah. And that's why one of the things that I ask in, you know, if I'm going through an assessment and especially with a platform deal, and I do it also with roll-ups, is I'll always ask the executive, what's the secret sauce? What's the thing here that is exactly what got you here and what should never be changed? And most of the time it's the team and kind of the way that the team operates. Nobody's ever saying, oh, our bad accounting practices is what got us here, right? It might be our ability to move fast. It might be our ability to make quick decisions, right? And just identifying what are some of those things. And how can you grow and scale what has been important to them?
Yeah, all critical. So we're running short on time. I'd like to offer each of you the opportunity to share a pearl of wisdom from today's conversation you'd like to make sure our audience walks away with. Matt, I'll start with you.
Sure. I guess mine is sort of two dimensions. We talked about the importance of a broad, you started out this conversation about human capital versus talent versus HR. And I believe it's an imperative for private equity firms to really have a broad view of their human capital strategy. And a human capital strategy is got to be more than just rip and replace the CEO or CFO. That, you know, getting the right team in place is important, but a broad talent or human capital strategy, it's got to be way more than that, right? And that just doing executive search and doing an assessment of your management team, and that's the extent of your human capital strategy, is really leaving the putt short. And so I think there's a lot of work that can be done on that front. And then the second dimension that I would share is, I see that there's a lot of time spent on the individual assessment and selection of executives. So get the right CEO in place, get the right CFO in place, get the right CHRO in place, get the right revenue leader in place. And that's important. And that is a really, really important first step. But what I often see lacking in a lot of portfolio companies, probably one of the most common problems I see across portfolio companies that I don't necessarily see a lot of PE firms trying to help solve for, is what I'll just call management team effectiveness, or in my opinion, management team ineffectiveness, where they're, you might individually have a lot of really strong players, but collectively they are not a high performing team, right? So how do we fix that? How do we improve that? How do we make sure that they are a team that's aligned on strategy and value creation plans and purpose, vision, and values? How do we have clarity of roles and responsibilities across that management team? How do they have a good working relationship, that they trust each other, that they collaborate, that they debate, that they resolve conflict? All of those types of things are the indicators of a high-performing team, let alone a pet peeve of mine often is the sloppiness of the operating rhythm I see of a lot of management teams. How often do they meet? What do they cover in those meetings? Are they crisp? Do they take notes? Do they capture to-dos and decisions and actions? And that goes all the way to the board meetings as well, where you can kind of see a real sloppiness in that. And so this construct of, like, we can spend a lot of time getting the right people in the right seats on the right bus, but we still need that group to operate like a high-performing team. And we want this to be more than a bus. We want this to be a sports car, right, that actually high-performance sports car. So to play off that analogy, those are two things that I think there's still a huge opportunity and a lot of runway within private equity firms of the value that they can add to their portfolio companies.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Mark, your thoughts?
I'd say the defense of incrementalism, right? All of these radical things and trying to do everything at once leads to confusion, leads to resistance, leads to a lot of that sloppy play that you're talking about, Matt, right? When coming into an organization and trying to turn everything on its head, when, you know, during the diligence you said, oh, it's going to be just the same, right? And you were great, and we're investing in you and what you've done. And so recognizing that small incremental changes will have radical exponential results, and just doing the right thing and building the right habits and taking the culture that exists, if it's a good culture, and just complementing it and building around it. Because those are the simplest people practices are going to be the most effective, right? There's a crazy phenomenon within psychology, and Laura, you've heard me say this a lot, but if you tell people what you expect them to do, they're more likely to do it. And so creating an organization where there's good communication and there's removal of ambiguity, you're going to have a lot of that good team effectiveness, because everybody's at least going to know this is the playbook that we're working off of.
And I think my wraparound to those things, Mark, the expectation setting was something I was going to chime in on if you didn't. We see this quite a bit, right? Particularly in founder-led organizations, where the founder then becomes the CEO of an organization that is charged with inorganic growth or exponential growth over a short period of time. In many cases, they've never had a board. They don't understand what board responsibility is. No one's sharing the expectation or coaching them to become a really effective next gen leader for the organization they created in the first place. So that it becomes a really critical imperative to even figuring out what your role as a CEO is now in this new stage. You're not the chief cook and bottle washer any longer. You are a visionary, and there are, you know, other roles and responsibilities you're expected to play. How do we get you to that place? I also think, from the standpoint of creating super effective organizations, being really intentional about the culture, not only the culture you've created that's gotten you to where you're going, but the culture you intend to create moving forward. If you are not attending to that, things are going to leak out sideways, and it's going to create all kinds of problems. You're also going to be held as a leader. You're going to be held to the standard you've set from an espoused values standpoint. And if you're not walking your own talk, all of a sudden, whatever social and relational capital you've created in your organization starts to erode, and you want to be really careful about those things. Matt, Mark, I have so appreciated having this conversation and sharing these thoughts with our audience. I can't wait for us to have yet another discussion about some of these things. We'll be back again in the not too distant future. For all of you watching and listening to us, we thank you for spending time. If you are interested in connecting with us, 29bison.com, please reach out at any time. We'd be happy to lend an ear, be a resource, provide references and resources to you and to your teams as you think about human capital strategy, talent, human resources, culture, talent assessment, and as we've seen, org design. So thank you all.